session on Australian credit. Our topic this morning is measuring credit portfolio risk. And we have a team of experts that are going to tell us about the types of risk within credit portfolios and how to manage the anticipated risks and to shed some light for us on the unanticipated risks or what they determine as tail events. Now, please welcome our researcher, Paul O'Connor from Standard & Poor's, and our partner host, Tracy Eaton from Colonial First State, who's now going to introduce our speaker this morning.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Colonial First State's Due Diligence Forum this morning. And as Kathleen has already pointed out, the title today is Risk in Credit Portfolios. My name is Tracy Eaton. I'd like to formally welcome you and thank you again for joining us. I'd like to start by being perhaps a little controversial and suggesting that not many of you in the room today will know a great deal about the world's largest asset class. I'd like to be perhaps even more controversial and suggest that equities are firmly in the past and credit really is the asset class of the future. Our session today intends to educate you about credit, how to understand and manage credit risk, and also how to take advantage of some of the current opportunities. To educate you on this topic, I'd like to introduce our speaker today, Sarah Percy-Dove, who is the Head of Credit Research at Colonial First State Global Asset Management. Sarah manages the credit research team, which provides credit research and monitoring for total FUM in excess of $40 billion. Just to outline a little bit about Sarah's past without wanting to embarrass her too much, but Sarah was previously Head of Credit Research Markets at ANZ, during which time she was voted number one for Australian credit research and analysis by the InStone magazine in both 2006 and 2007. She has a wealth of credit experience over the last 20 years. I hope that doesn't give you your age, Sarah, including a stint in Singapore covering Asian credit markets for Alliance Bernstein, followed by a role at Merrill Lynch in London as a sell-side credit analyst. I'm sure you'll agree Sarah is eminently qualified to talk to us about this subject today. Please join me in welcoming Sarah.
Thanks, Tracy. Now, welcome. Thank you very much for coming. Measuring portfolio credit risk can be a little bit of a dry topic, so I will try and make it as easily digestible as possible. And I must say, having a PhD in mathematics employed for Colonial First State, who is also very much the author of the information I'm about to present, which is Dr. Leah Kelly, is also here to help me out with what can be some rather difficult mathematical aspects of the portfolio risk measurement. And I'll go through the disclaimer for anyone who's interested. Now, I think the best way to start this is imagine that you run a supermarket. I think you all know, are pretty familiar with your local Coles or your local Woolies. And what you do if you have to manage that business is you have to buy stock, you have to put it on the shelves, and then you have to sell it. You have to think about what processes you need to put in place to manage that business. You need to think about the operational risks that you might be facing, and you need to identify them. And then not only once you identify them, you need to figure out how to manage them going forward and to minimise them. So you run a supermarket. What do you expect to happen? As a normal part of operating a supermarket, particularly if you have fruit and vegetables, you expect wastage. You expect some of your fruit and vegetables to go off before the customers buy them. You know your bread will go stale at some point. You know that despite everything, the butchers get lazy occasionally and they'll leave a fair bit of meat on the cutting room floor. You also know you're going to have things like theft. You're going to have a little bit of staff usage, a little bit of client tasting, and unfortunately a little bit of shoplifting. This is operational risk. This is part and parcel with running your business. These are just some of the things you need to deal with. How do you manage that operational risk, or what we would call expected loss? Well, to control that wastage issue, you're going to introduce leading-edge inventory control, just-in-time delivery of your stock. You monitor stock levels, and that's where barcodes have had an amazing influence in the retail sector specifically. You can manage your stock very, very carefully. You climate control your fruit and veggie section. I don't mind getting that nice spray of water as you walk past the spinach section in a lot of the supermarkets these days. And you also start training your staff. You train your butchers to make sure that they do the cutting of the meat in the most efficient manner. To control theft, you employ store detectives, you check bags, you train and educate your staff. This is operational risk management. This is what you do to manage the risks associated with your business on an everyday basis. But sometimes stuff happens. Some unexpected, unusual stuff. Your freezers break down, or you have a power failure. You have industrial action impacting the supply of your chickens. Or, in even a bigger sense, you could have a competitor like Harris Farm open next door and the turnover in your fruit and veggie section plummets. This is what we call unexpected loss. These are losses which are a little bit bigger and atypical than you would usually expect. So managing unexpected loss is also part of what you do. You have backup freezers in place. You have the phone number of Harry the hirer who can get you backup generators on site in about half a day. You stock frozen chickens so your clients don't go looking elsewhere for the product they want. And you offer loyalty programs or cut prices in order to keep your customers walking through the front door. This is what we call risk management. Sometimes, though, something really, really, really bad happens. A truck arrives at 2 o'clock in the morning and backs through the back of your store. The resulting explosion and fireball totally destroys not only the shop, but all of the stock inside. Thankfully, it's in the middle of the night and the truck driver gets out. What type of risk is this, other than really, really bad? This is what we call tail risk. This is not a variation on a usual type of risk you would face managing your business. This is an extreme event. This is what we call a tail event. Ooh. And what defines a tail event is that the probability of occurring is extremely small, but the outcome of it happening is absolutely catastrophic. It's a total wipeout. And in your own lives, you'll actually be managing tail risk because most of you, I'm sure, will have insurance on your car or your home. And that is there designed usually just for the tail risk event. If we take these concepts and move them into a credit portfolio context, with any business in credit portfolio management, we have things we just expect, our expected losses. If we lend people money, there is no question over time that some of them won't repay us. So as a result, the expected loss in a credit portfolio is defaults. And that's absolutely part and parcel of our business. We will, without question, have defaults if you own credit. Now, the likelihood of a default, very intuitively simple. If they are a high-risk borrower, then there is a higher risk of default. If they're a low-risk borrower, a high-quality name, an investment-grade name, then the risk of default is substantially lower. Now, not only is this intuitively correct, it's also statistically correct, because Standard & Poor's and Moody's have been tracking the actual default data for over 100 years. And we know to the 10th decimal place in any one year what our expected loss is as a result. How do we manage expected loss? Well, we do a lot, as much as we can, to minimise them. Obviously, any defaults are something we're trying to avoid. We implement industry-best credit monitoring systems. We employ quality credit analysts. At Colonial First State, we have 11. And we spend a lot of time also understanding the legal structure around the investments that we undertake. But in short, what we do is we implement best practice processes to ensure that we minimise the expected risk or the expected loss in the portfolio. And for portfolio credit management, we call this operational risk management. We also have exposures to unexpected losses. Because as I said, statistically we know that in the high yield world, we have 2.345387.6 defaults a year. Now clearly, you can't actually have that number. They're obviously whole numbers. But more importantly, in many years we have zero defaults And in other years, we have a lot of defaults. The average is low, but the actuality of it is very, very diverse. So it's this variability around the losses each year that are actually imposed can be significant. And this is what we call unexpected loss. So these are the times when losses are quite different to what is normally expected on a day-to-day basis. How do we manage unexpected loss in credit portfolios? Well, for most, the answer to a lot of these questions is diversification. So what you do is you make sure you have a lot of different investments in your portfolio. In the case of the supermarket, you're not just going to sell potatoes. You're going to sell every vegetable you can get supply for. And so for credit portfolio, we're going to have a lot of different issuers. We're going to look for a number of different industries, different geographical areas. We are also going to make sure that our concentration, our investment in any one particular investment is not too large. We don't want to have our returns reliant on just one part of the investment. So if you're running your supermarket, you don't want 50% of your profit coming from spinach. This is what we do to manage unexpected loss. It's a lot of diversification and ensuring that our concentrations are within the parameters we're comfortable with. Some days, though, you can have very, very bad days in credit. So this graph shows you the actual defaults that have occurred since 1970 for BBB credits from Moody's. Now, the red line is the average. So the average default, which is our expected loss, is 17 basis points per annum for this type of credit risk. As you can see, though, in no year have we actually achieved 17 basis points. In most of the years, we've had no defaults at all. And then in 2 years in particular, in 87 and 2002, you can see we've had a significantly large number of defaults. How do you manage those really, really bad days in credit? You need to understand correlation risk. Correlation is if one issuer defaults, what is the likelihood of another also defaulting? And you can have almost invisible threads linking companies that could trigger associated defaults for reasons which might not be typical. It might not be, you know, an industry sector. It might not even be geographical. For instance, in Europe, there was a lot of telecoms companies that ended up getting into trouble because they were bidding for 3G licenses and paid too much for it. But you need to understand that you can have correlation risk. So in the case of a supermarket, you would want to invest in four supermarkets in four different areas, not four supermarkets in the one shopping centre. That would be correlation. Again, coming back to diversify, diversify, diversify. Have a number of issuers, have a number of industries, have a number of countries, and manage your concentration risk so that there's no one investment that is driving your returns. Most importantly of all is that you need to know what your risks are. So you need to be able to identify them, you need to be able to measure them, you need to know which investments are driving them, and then you can then put in place any processes to minimise them, if that's where you want to go. So just to recap, there are three ways of looking at credit risk in your portfolio. The expected loss is that average loss. That's that red dotted line. Unexpected loss measures the variability around actual losses to expected losses. So that's that difference. And then we have tail risk. And that's where the extreme measures come through. So these are the three aspects of credit risk in your portfolios. So there are a number of market standard measures out there which you might think gives you some sort of information about credit risk in portfolios. So I just wanted to go through them. You'll often hear about average credit ratings, credit duration, tracking error, and value at risk. So what do they tell us about credit risk? Let's talk about average credit rating. My portfolio has an average credit rating of AA. What does this tell you about credit risk in the portfolio? Nothing. What it tells you is how much you would expect to lose over time due to defaults. It doesn't tell you anything about how many issues you have in your portfolio, how many sectors are represented, what sort of concentration risks are in there. It doesn't even tell you if you have insurance. So it doesn't tell you anything other than what your expected default is over time. Credit duration, often quoted. My portfolio has a credit duration of 3.2 years. What does that tell you? Nothing. What it tells you is on average how much you would expect to lose in value in your portfolio if spreads were to widen by 1 basis point, or in the case of a supermarket, if your inventory hold period extended. It assumes also that all your losses are uniform, that you lose the same amount on every single investment. So your tomatoes have the same loss rate as your toilet paper. That is not correct. Tracking error. It's a big one. Tracking error. My portfolio has a tracking error of 50 basis points. This must tell me something about my credit risk. Surprise. Doesn't tell you anything about credit risk in your portfolio. What it tells you is how volatile your actual losses were compared to what you expected to lose. It does not tell you anything about whether this pattern is likely to repeat. And, more importantly, it says absolutely nothing about why. Was it due to skill? Was it good management? Was it luck? And it implicitly assumes, incorrectly, that credit has a normal distribution of returns. Now, this is where it gets a little bit tricky. Normal distribution is the blue curve. And as you can see, if you're just looking at that, it's very symmetrical. And what a normal distribution effectively says is that there is the same probability of upside or downside around that mean. So risks are exactly the same, up, they're evenly weighted. Now, please take my word for it when I tell you that over time it's been modelled, the equity market approximates that normal distribution curve. That is roughly how the returns on that market have been generated. Now, what is crucial to understand, though, is that the bond market does not share this type of relationship. And the reason for that is that for bonds, there is no upside. What we know for a fact is the best we can do in investing in bonds is that we get back our principal plus all of the interest payments that the company's made. That's it. There is no super normal returns available to bond investors. As a result, the curve is asymmetrical. What that means is that the upside is limited and the downside is not. So we spend a lot of our time looking at the downside risk. So tracking error is appropriate for equity markets because it measures most of the probability for their curve, for their outcomes. But to measure, use tracking error in the same, with a different, with an asymmetrical curve doesn't actually achieve anything of value to us. What we want is we want to know what this is. These are the extreme outcomes. This is tail risk, hence the name. And it's this part of the curve that we're most interested in understanding and measuring. Which brings us to another market measure which is used. It's called value at risk, often VAR is what it's called. So my portfolio has a VAR of $30 million. What does this tell you about credit risk in your portfolio? Well, finally, it does start to tell us something, but still, it's just not quite there. What it tells you is at a certain confidence level over a certain period of time, we wouldn't expect to lose more than $30 million. So what it does is it's measuring a data point on the curve, and it's just one point along here. That's what VAR is. What it doesn't say, though, because it's only measuring that one point, is in situations where we might lose more than 30 million, how much more? Or in situations where we lose close to but not quite 30 million, how much and how often? So while it gives us a little bit of the flavour that we're looking for, it doesn't really give us, you know, the real juice to it. So now we come to what we call conditional value at risk, CVAR, as it's known. This measures tail risk. This is tail risk is what we care about. My portfolio has a CVaR of $30 million. What does this tell you about credit risk in the portfolio? Tells you an awful lot, but you still need to make sure you understand some of the parameters which it's talking about. So we've got this asymmetrical curve again. And what we see with CVaR is instead of having just the one point that it's measuring with VaR, what it does is it measures the area of the tail. So it captures all of this. It captures how long it is, how fat it is. It gives us some idea of the catastrophic risk that's embedded in our portfolio. So it tells us how bad can it get in our portfolio. And that's pretty powerful. That's about as powerful as we can get at the moment, is understanding the size and the shape of tail risk in portfolios. And in our view, once you set a confidence level and a time period that you're happy with, then it is actually quite a powerful way of measuring credit portfolio risk. So there's some simple things you should be thinking about when you're assessing credit risk in portfolios. You want to know how big is the tail. Is it too big? What names or investments are contributing the most to it? So I guess I should point out, we get a number for CVaR. That's easy to do. We then are capable of running millions of different functions through Monte Carlo analysis, and we can pick out on a name-by-name, security-by-security basis, we can figure out what's contributing to this tail risk and which areas are providing the largest part of that. And so we can analyse our portfolios and figure out exactly what the contributors are. So why are they contributing it? This can pick up correlation risks, which may not be too obvious. And then you want to know how significant are these contributors. And so it's only once you understand the tail risk that's embedded in the portfolio and its contributors and really understand the risk aspects in credit, are you then able to take that and make comparisons across different products. Because in credit, it's risk-adjusted returns, not just outright returns, because you will often see products where we consider risk isn't being measured correctly and hence the returns look in excess of where they should be. So what I thought we would do is maybe give you a little test. On the next slide, there are 11 events. There's a mix of expected loss, unexpected loss, and tail risk. So it goes quickly, it's only for a minute. See if you can pick what's what. It's my personal favourite. I promise only stupid people were hurt in the making of this video. Okay. For some reason, it doesn't like me having that slide up. I'm not sure why. I can tell you if you're interested which ones they are. I don't know why it's doing that. Oh, I know what I'll do. Let's do it this way. Hopefully you can see that. So there, basically the tail risk was the guy getting the football in the face while he's eating his ice cream. Playing soccer, you don't really expect to be taken out by Tarzan. And the family photo. I don't think you expect to fall into water getting a photo taken. The others, essentially, if you were stupid, it was expected loss. And if you were... and if, you know, there was maybe a little bit of, you know, substance to their decision-making, then it was unexpected loss. So I'm going to open it up now for questions. Or give it to Tracy to do that, in fact. There we go.
It's often said that, or it is said that financial risk...
Thank you.
in Main Street financial stocks, where it comes to credit, that, you know, the central bankers of the world won't let a Main Street bank collapse. Now, when it comes to the analysis, because a number of funds, credit funds, will have significant weightings to financial stocks,
yes.
Do they have a different default rate than, you know, a typical similar credit rating stock?
Sure.
And how do you build in, other than just an intuitive feel, for that implied, you know, financial system support?
Sure, I understand. I'll use the Australian banks as an example. It's probably the easiest. The ratings of the Australian banks do not include any credit for Australian government support because regulatory, the government's actually not obliged to support them. If you look at the actual law. Now, that doesn't mean, though, that if you have a large number of Australian banks in your portfolio, then clearly there's a correlation risk there because they're all highly leveraged to the Australian economy. So there's actual risk that you do take in taking that. The question is not really if you're taking on risk, it's do you understand what it is and are you getting rewarded for it? So I think the answer to your question is more along the lines of, yes, there will be a lot of risks associated currently with the financial sector and investing in them. Do we understand them? At Colonial First State, I would say we do. Are we aware of the correlation risks? Absolutely. Do we then go and factor that into the spread return that we receive in investing in those names? Absolutely. And notwithstanding those risks, which are definitely there, we feel we're being actually overly compensated right now for investing in Australian banks. So my answer is not that we're ignoring the risks or we're not, you know, understanding them. The answer is that we understand the risk, and hence our investments in Australian banks right now we find very attractive because we think we're being compensated for them. And one of the reasons for that is, in our opinion, any one of the big four, the government would step in to support in the event that it found itself floundering. Because the correlation between the big fours is also highly interrelated as well. So it would be very hard for the Australian government, in our view, to let one go without it having a major impact on the others. So hopefully that answered your question. Yeah.
That's on?
Yes.
That's on?
Yes.
Some... view ending 30th of June, 08, some high-profile hybrid fixed income funds have shown losses of 7 to 10%.
Yes.
Could you tell us what factors have contributed to that and what factors might contribute to their recovery?
I have to say we don't have a hybrid fund that has been impacted to that end, so I'm going to speculate. In fact, I would be very sure in telling you that there were risks embedded in that portfolio that were never measured. Because I think the same funds that you're discussing also had super returns compared to their competitors for a period prior to their latest performance. So what sort of risks perhaps weren't captured by their measurement? Well, I would say liquidity risk for one. A lot of the hybrids, in fact, most hybrids are very illiquid securities. It's very difficult to be able to sell them quickly into a liquid market. So the measurement of that liquidity risk has obviously been absent prior. I think that there was also concentration risks in those hybrid portfolios, in part because of their portfolio philosophy, in part because it's actually quite a limited asset class. So you also had a large number of investments which had the capacity to, you know, heavily impair your returns if they defaulted. And I would also suggest that that's part of the problem. How will they recover? I guess I can only speculate. Some will not recover. The construction of that portfolio had so many aspects about it that they can't recover. It's all about winding it down, particularly where investors lose confidence and start withdrawing money. It becomes very difficult for portfolio managers to then do anything other than, you know, manage it downward. Recovery will probably be dependent on the economy going forward, because what you're relying on there is to lower the expected default rates going forward. And I guess you would need to take a view on whether or not that's likely to occur in the short term. The other way is to invest another large portion of money into that fund to ride the cycle and to invest in spreads today at levels that more than compensate you for the risk, and then you try and even it out over time. You can't do that on an individual basis, though, unless you're an extremely wealthy Packer-related person, because typically these funds are, you know, in the tens to hundreds of millions of dollars. So, sorry, just at the front.
Thanks, Trice. Might be a question better for Dr. Leah there, but credit rating migration risk, and typically that's classified as a market risk, but in the extreme event of a security defaulting, it becomes a credit risk. Does conditional value at risk tell us anything about a portfolio's migration risk?
It's definitely for Dr. Kelly.
I prefer Dr. Leah. It really depends on how you set up the model that you're going to use to model your credit risk. So in our world, when I worked in the credit team, the way we set it up was that credit migration risk was resulting in that CVaR number. Can you strip it out and say 10% of the CVaR is because of credit migration? No, not really. While Sarah made it sound really, really easy, the actual credit portfolio modelling that goes on is actually quite complicated. So to pull out that data is not easy. The only way I think you could do it, again, comes back to your approach. If you explicitly say, right, here I have my Standard & Poor's transition matrix, you could possibly work backwards. But the problem with like a CVaR or a VaR number, from my view, is that because they take into account all these correlations that you can't see, it can be very, very difficult to go from CVaR backwards to another number. So in answer, it is captured, but I couldn't tell you what the number actually was. I hope that answers your question.
Sorry, there's a gentleman right down the back. Yep.
Thank you. I acknowledge that a lot of the stuff that you're doing is based upon statistical, historic statistical stuff. But I would have thought we're in an era at the moment where we're actually in ground where statistics don't really matter a damn, because you've got credit events emerging everywhere, securitization markets, which have grown enormously over the last 10 or 15 years, frozen. You've got billions, trillions of dollars of debt with tenor, but no new owner. What on earth does that do to CVaR?
Well, I think there's maybe two parts. Well, it doesn't do anything to CVaR if you don't own those assets. So I'm happy to say Colonial First State doesn't own those assets, so it's probably not something we've spent an enormous amount of time worrying about, other than, you know, in terms of our market analysis, definitely. Obviously, it's an impact.
Yeah, but you do own those assets.
We don't... To some degree. As I said, there's definitely... What you're talking about is market risk right now. I think, I don't know, Leah, if you're going to agree with me there. This is where I need to be reassured by the mathematician here. I think some of the aspect of what you're talking about would be classified as market risk rather than credit risk.
Yes,
yep.
That's right.
Good. Feel free to jump in at any time. We certainly know and are, again, I'll come back to... Investments in financial institutions are problematic right now. They are a cause for considerable pause when investing in them. Don't get me wrong. But we look at risk on a return basis. And if we feel we understand the risk, then we will invest. And right now, Colonial First State feels that highly rated banks that have either implicit or explicit or are too big to fail by any, you know, OECD country offer incredibly good risk return reward at this point. So notwithstanding, we certainly understand that there's market risk in there. What we've also seen to moderate that is that the banks have also been recapitalising very quickly. So we don't mind if the equity market wants to reduce the risk for the credit market at any time. Feel free. But in terms of how it impacts SIVA, I'm not sure I can answer that effectively.
I'll address it. Sorry, I'll stand so I can see you. In part, I agree. Obviously, anything that's backward-looking is going to have problems whenever there is a stress event, if you like, and that's what this is. What you will usually see is people complement this kind of risk analysis with a stress test analysis as well. So they have, right, equity markets tank 30% in one day, bond yields do stupid things, currencies go out the window. So they will actually complement that. And they know, and we know that these models have their flaws. One thing that I will say, and you're quite right to point this out, what we missed, or what is missing and has turned out to be very, very significant, is liquidity risk. Now, it wasn't priced properly by the market. I think nearly everybody agrees with that statement. But also, it's one of those things that's very, very difficult to measure. And I'm of the view that mathematics and statistics can only do so much. And so to pretend that I can measure liquidity risk is basically... I mean, I can produce a pretty model to do almost anything. It just doesn't mean it's going to work. So, I mean, in response to that, I would say that, yes, this has its flaws, but it doesn't mean it's useless.
Yes. There's no perfect measure. There isn't. Look, it's selective. Don't get me wrong. It's selective and subjective. But you can't tell me after the bailout of Bear Stearns that the US government is going to stand by and let Citigroup fall over. We are. But I would... It's a difference of opinion. In that context. So I totally agree. We're vigilant, definitely vigilant, in monitoring these risks. This is not something that we do and set and forget. There is just one more there. Yep. Okay. Do we have this gentleman? Oh, sorry, this guy at the back. I didn't see this one. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Would that improve, or would that have protected us to some degree and given us better outcomes?
I just got a shrug from Leah. Look, I think hindsight's a beautiful thing. I think if we went back in time to the Asian crisis in 1997, we might have said the same thing there. Go back to 2002, tech wreck. Keep going back to the 70s.
But at the interesting point, he actually argues what you're arguing there. He's saying we keep going over these big events.
They keep happening.
Over, they keep occurring.
Yep.
And yet, when we do our statistical modelling and all that, we tend to forget about how often these.
Well, if you want to capture those what you can do with the SEVA particularly is that you can move how much of the tail risk that you measure. Okay, so you actually, that's your option depending on, you know, that's your confidence level, so and your time period. So the area under that tail can change depending on what parameters you put in. So if you assume that you're picking up all of the tail risk, then you should be seeing your CVAR number reflect those probabilities. Well, I think it helps you understand the risk. Let's be clear here. None of these measures make you avoid tail risk, right? All it does is it helps you understand what the risk is that's embedded in the portfolio, and are you getting rewarded for it? Okay, portfolio management is not about avoiding risk at all costs. Portfolio management is about being rewarded adequately for the risk that you're taking. So maybe it's more on the other side of that. Were we getting rewarded for the risk embedded in the portfolios for some period of time? And I think we would definitely argue no. And is there a quick one here? Okay.
I think we'll wrap it up for today. Would you join me, please, in thanking Sarah Persidiab and also Dr. Leah Kelly as well for her input? So just quickly, with regards to today, clearly, if you come and talk to us at the Colonial First State stand, we can chat to you a little bit more about our product, the Global Credit Income Fund, which clearly has all the characteristics that Sarah's talked about today in terms of the diversification across countries, in excess of, well, I think it's close on 600 issuers in that fund. So we're happy to talk to you a little bit more about that. But for now, I think we will move straight into the voting. Or Kathleen? Oh, I'm sorry. Paul O'Connor from Standard & Poor's is going to treat us now to just a bit of a summary as to his views on the fund and where it would fit into a portfolio. So, Paul.
Thanks, Trace. Interesting session there, and I guess a large portion of us have quite an exposure to credit in our defensive segment of our portfolios. I think probably just in the low inflation, low interest rate environment, that increased demand for yield in portfolios over the last 15 years or so, we have seen a migration away from traditional fixed interest into credit. But in actually exposing ourselves into credit, I know at Standard & Poor's, when we do make an allocation there, we are very focused on the size of the fund and hence the diversity of securities that the manager would hold, but then also how far down the risk spectrum that the portfolio manager will go with their portfolio and exposure to credit. Because ultimately we see it as there is no great upside to investing in this subsector of fixed interest. But obviously, when you get credit risk and the extreme event of a security defaulting, you can lose significant monies in this space. So I guess we look for a well-diversified manager. We also look for a manager that isn't going to take on too much risk in the portfolio for us. So I guess, in short, that's what we look for as a role of credit in a portfolio.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you, Sarah, Tracy and Dr. Leah as well for this morning's presentation. Now we conclude our session, and thank you to all the delegates who have come to this morning's presentation. Before you go, I need you to do your vote. So we're ready to do our vote now. Okay. And please leave your voting gizmos at the door when you leave. I think once we're finished, we could give a round of applause for our speakers.